This is the history of America in poems, and we are talking about children's poetry. And next up, we are talking about early American children's poetry from maybe the 1600s to the early 1800s. And again, this is kind of sparse territory in early American history. But there's a few poems that we can look at. And I want to start by saying, repeating something Angela Sorby said in her essay about early American children's poetry, that pre-20th century life, the life stages were not so fixed. So there was not really a childhood time that they catered to write special childhood editions. There weren't that many books to begin with anyway. And for many, many years, maybe 100 years or more, into Mark Twain time, there would be books that were published as household editions. There were these intergenerational editions that were seen as sort of like acceptable for children and adults. So they were safe for kids. But this idea of something being safe for kids was a different idea in colonial times. Anyway, so, and we'll get to why that is in a minute. But the early poems were kind of didactic. Puritans were very serious. And as they were the ones who were publishing the first books were pretty serious. They were much more serious than the people down in Boston and all the Southerners in the early Southern colonial states. And they were more religious for certain. But the colonial time saw a little bit of publishing growth, because once people stabilized their living situations, which were pretty harsh at first, they had some disposable income, and there was a demand for paper goods and magazines and newspapers. And so that started to pick up, and there were poems eventually in every magazine and newspaper. And sometimes, or oftentimes, editors would write poems themselves to fill in the gaps. If there were, you know, they were missing content and they needed something, the editor would just write a poem and stick it in there. So you'd see poems everywhere. And as people gained more disposable income too, they started giving each other gifts. That became a practice that happened over time. And poems were one of those things that were packaged as gift books. So gift books became a thing. And they're still a thing, you know, especially for children's books. And the middle class developed some free time and some disposable income, and mothers had time eventually to read to kids. So after the Revolution, maybe around the 1820s, literature started to be really distinctively American, have distinctively American characteristics. And we'll get to that, but there are some big early famous things that happened before that. And we're going to start with the New England Primer, which was a school book from the 1600s. Actually, it went from the 1600s to about 1835, when the schools changed over to the, or I'm sorry, not 1935, 1835, when the schools changed over to the McGuffey Reader. And we're going to talk about some of the children's poems that appeared in the McGuffey Reader when we get to 1835. But for now, one of the earliest New England poems, one of the earliest children's poems too, was this New England Primer. The Bay Psalm Book was actually the first printed book in the New World. So this, and they don't really quite know when this started to be published. The earliest time is kind of vague. So I can't say that it's a second book, but it's one of the earliest books. And it was basically an alphabet poem teaching letters to kids. And this is going to be a tradition that keeps on keeping on. And we're going to talk about an alphabet poem when we get to Edward Gorey in the 1950s. So this is a very popular way to speak to children by using the letters. And this New England primer was the first one, and few copies survive, unfortunately, because they were so well used in schools and all over America. And different versions happened, like different versions of the poem were written for different areas. And if you were in a maybe a religious town, your poem might be more religious. And if you lived in Boston, maybe your poem in your New England primer would be a little more secular. So I provided two examples. One is from Word Foundations, and there are two versions on that web page, and you should read them both because they're both, you could use just to show how different they were over time, how they evolved. And some were more secular and some were more of the Puritan worldview. And so there's a picture version, and then there's a text version on the page from 1777. And then I have another website that talks about the New England Primer from the Packard Library, and that's interesting to read through too. And it talks about the changes and why different areas were different and why pre-revolutionary versions were different than post-revolutionary versions because, you know, there were different ideas about the king. And so the king is spoken of positively before the revolution and then negatively after the revolution. So you'll see kind of how that poem evolved. There was no copyright law back then. So there was really no way to lock down the message that the Puritans intended when they first wrote this primer. And so market pressure and commerce, in a way, this poem got out of their hands and was used and rewritten in ways they probably didn't intend or approve of. But you'll see evidence of that in the different versions. So Angela Sorby has an interesting piece of trivia that Emily Dickinson in the late 1800s had a version of this primer from her childhood, and she cut up her version with scissors to illustrate her own verses, which was a delightful example of early multimedia poetry. So I'd love to see that. Anyway, the poem represents basically a Puritan worldview of religion and the early American work ethic. And there's death in the poem because poems back then did intend explicitly to prepare children for the idea of death. Child mortality was really high, and everybody was much more familiar with death. And because the Puritans believed that the Bible was the key to salvation, they wanted their kids to learn to read the Bible as soon as they could. And so, to save their souls, this book was created to teach children how to read so that they could start reading the Bible. And then, if they unfortunately died before they exited childhood, they would have a chance to get saved. So this is an early version of sort of proselytizing American identity. This is early spin about who Americans are. And this a lot of this is around the changing ideas of who the king is. Like we're defining ourselves against something, in support of some things and in opposition to other things. So we're also America's gaining ground with their economy. And so there's regional flexibility, there's demographic flexibility. That's why there's so many different versions of this poem. There's no really canonical version of it. And so it's an interesting first poem, the New England Primer. So next I want to move on to other poems that you know. These are famous poems that you're familiar with. And one of them, the first one, is the Christmas poem I spoke of in the introduction. It's called A Visit from St. Nicholas by Clement Clark Moore. And it's from 1823. And we know this poem today very well as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. But it's really titled A Visit from St. Nicholas. And it was published in the Sentinel newspaper with a picture alongside it. And historians believe that this picture is much, the picture was pretty much
just reinforcing everything in the paper, but this had a huge influence on Americans' idea of Christmas, and it changed their ideas of what Christmas was. It was widely republished, and then it was turned into a gift book. It's still a gift book. It's still given to children at Christmas time. And it's the earliest, most popular secular American poem, especially for children. Angela Sorby says it has probably the most famous opening couplet in American history. And we all know it. It is, "'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse." And this poem is extraordinary because it shaped our notions of Christmas celebrations, like the details of it. You know, Clement Clark Moore describes Christmas in these fantastical, magical, idyllic terms, full of optimism and idealism, and it's sensational. This is a sensational poem. It's the magic of it is beyond reality. And it also describes what we'll talk about a lot all through the history of American poetry, but this idea of a sentimental domestic space. And what we mean by that is sort of the house being a safe. We'll read lines of the poem that kind of we'll get to this more when we get to the Thanksgiving poem coming up in a little bit, but the home is portrayed as safe, idyllic, warm, full of great food. This is going to change over time. So, and this has a lot to do with the fact that conditions had been really hard for people. And so they just wanted to stabilize the home. I'll talk about this more in a minute, but over time, this is going to change when we get to the 1900s. This idea of what the sentimental domestic space means for Americans. But this poem particularly was a shift from talking about Christmas as a church-based tradition to a home-based tradition. So how you celebrate Christmas at home with your family. And these are new ideas about Christmas that are being codified. And Americans are sort of united. This was such a popular poem that Americans were uniting around these ideas expressed in this poem about who Santa was and what Christmas was. And up to that time, according to Angela Sorby, there was a split in how Americans experienced Christmas between the upper class and the working class. And this poem kind of started to unite Americans and how they celebrated Christmas. It was a new time of gift giving, and so it's a little bit materialistic. And this is going to be interesting when we compare it a hundred years later or more to Dr. Seuss writing about the Grinch who stole Christmas and what Christmas means. And we're still arguing over what Christmas means in America. So this is not a small site of conflict. This poem is full of amazing details that were invented in the poem. The reindeer are named. They don't have names before this. There's no Rudolph yet, but there's stockings, there's a chimney, there's a sleigh and a sack of presents. Santa's chubby. He's never been chubby before. He's always been a thin Santa. The line, "Happy Christmas to all and to all a good night." We know this. This is a very popular line that we still see on Christmas cards and everywhere. Interestingly, this poem was structurally based on the model of another poem from the colonial days, a poem called "The Day of Doom" by a minister named Michael Wigglesworth, and his poem was about the Day of Judgment. So it's an interesting structural foundation for this poem because this is so much more magical. But we'll get to that poem because it's an important poem too. So when we get to colonial poetry, we'll circle back to the Day of Doom. But this poem is the opposite of the Day of Doom. This is the Day of Magic. And we say it's written by Clement Clark Moore, but the writer's claim to the poem is now kind of shaky. Some believe the poem was actually written by a New York writer named Henry Livingston, but it's still credited to Moore. So another point is it's kind of late. It's kind of late for our first classic children's poem. It's 1823. And this, we've moved out of our colonial period and we're into our nation building era. So it took us a while to write a children's poem, a piece of children's literature that became popular. Just to give it context, Grimm's Fairy Tales was first published in English in the same year, 1823. There just wasn't a lot of children's literature yet. Hans Christian Andersen, his stories were first translated into English later in 1846. And Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, which was dubbed the Watershed of Nonsense, and nonsense is going to be important later. We're going to talk about that pretty soon. That wasn't published till 1865. And then Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson didn't come out until 1883. Growing up, I had a book of Robert Louis Stevenson's poetry too, and it was called A Child's Garden of Verses. And I had that on my dresser. My parents put it on my dresser, and I had it on my dresser for my whole childhood. It wasn't published till 1885. So anyway, just looking at the poem for a minute, I'll just talk about some of the features of it. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in the hopes that St. Nicholas would soon be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds. How cozy. This is so cozy. While visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. Good food, cozy beds. When out on the lawn, there arose such a clatter, I sprang from the bed to see what was the matter. The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow. When what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and eight tiny reindeer. And so then he names all the reindeer. There's the housetop, the sleigh full of toys. Santa comes down the chimney, and he has toys flung on his back. His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, how merry. His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. Let's see. His beard was white. He had a pipe that he held tight in his teeth. And the smoke, it circled his head like a wreath. He had a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf. So, in the end, it gets like a little bit of conspiracy. And you've seen this. I've seen this image so many times. Like on postcards or posters of Santa Claus laying his finger aside of his nose and giving a nod up the chimney he rose. So it's like a little secret between the kid who's viewing this and his view of Santa Claus. So amazing how these ideas seem so stereotypical and cliche about Santa and Christmas. But we have to try to read this with the minds of somebody from 1823 who doesn't know any of these details. And this is all new and amazing and so popular that we will still be envisioning these ideas about Christmas today. So that's a visit from St. Nicholas. The next poem, the next famous children's poem of early America that you know it as a Mary Had a Little Lamb, but its real title is Mary's Lamb from 1830. And it's by Sarah Josepha Hale. And again, I think there might be some controversy about the authorship of this poem too, just like the other one. It was kind of hard back in the day to verify who was writing things. But this is a very famous poem from a magazine. It was printed first in a magazine called Juvenalia Miscellany Magazine, and it was widely, widely reprinted. And it was also in this author's 1830 collection called Poems for Our Children. And Again, this is seen as like a sentimental space, the school house, the love of animals. Some people consider this one of the first animal rights poems because, you know, she's expressing sort of love for her lamb. Women were seen as being more empathetic. So, you know, empathy, kindness is being encouraged in this poem. But also female education, which was not a given at the time. This girl is going to school. And so that is kind of a progressive statement for 1830. And she's not only going to school, but she's making a challenge to authority because she's bringing a pet to school. And so this is part of American character building. Sometimes you got to challenge authority and think about liberty and having a pure spirit and a moral light. And Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. He followed her to school one day, and that was against the rule. So there we go. Rule breaker. So the final thing, I'm not going to read much more of that poem. It's a short poem. But a piece of trivia about it is that it was the poem that was included as the first audio recording ever made by Thomas Edison on his phonograph in 1877. So it has that distinction going for it. The next poem I do want to spend more time with, and it's called The New England Boy's Song About Thanksgiving Day, and it's otherwise known as Over the River and Through the Wood. And it's from 1845. We all know this because it was turned into a song. And it was also in Lydia Marie Child's collection of poetry called Flowers for Children, Volume 2. And it has a famous first line, just like our Christmas poem, Over the River and Through the Woods to Grandfather's House We Go. It was Grandfather. We were going to Grandfather's house in the beginning. It was a gift book. Hey, wait, I'm going to back up a minute. So I just had a thought. It's Grandfather's house in the beginning because we had not yet gendered the home space. I'm going to talk about that later. It's going to become a big deal. Like, it became grandmother's house because eventually the house became gendered. And they changed it from grandfather's house to grand. We're going to grandmother's house because the house belongs to the woman, grandmother. I'm gonna harp on that again in a minute. But like the Christmas poem, this was also a gift book. And we don't know who wrote the music. It was an unknown composer. Like the Christmas poem and Mary Had a Little Lamb, this was reprinted and reprinted in many, many newspapers. But this poem is longer, and so it's longer than the other two poems that we've talked about. And so in different newspaper printings, editors would cut stanzas out. So not every printing had the same amount of stanzas. And so not everybody really read the same poem. It too was made into a record in 1947 on Decca Records, and it became a radio tradition every year to hear the song played. So that's partially why we still know it today. Lydia Marie Child was an abolitionist writer. She supported the ending of slavery. This was 1845, before the Civil War. She was also a journalist and a teacher. And Angela Sorby notes that in her essay about this poem and other children's poems, that back in the day, the northern states saw more snow at Thanksgiving. And so there's snow at Thanksgiving in this poem. And originally it was the wood, you know, over the river and through the wood. Now we sing over the river and through the woods because we think of a set of trees as woods and not a wood, as they did back then. And I also want to point out that it's the earliest travel poem that I have found. This is a small road trip that we're taking. We're going literally over the river and through the woods to get to grandmother's house. And there's perils and difficult going. And it's a journey.
So coming back to this idea of the domestic space, and this poem is full of it, full of that. That, you know, they go through the over the river and through the woods to grandfather's house we go. We would not stop for Dollar Top, for it's Thanksgiving Day. How the wind does blow, it sings the toes and bites the nose, and over the ground we go. This is not easy going. It's not hard. It's hard to travel back in this time period. The sleigh gets upset into a bank of snow. They crash. So they finally get to grandfather's house, and there's pudding and pumpkin pie in a nice warm kitchen. So again, home means like survival space. You know, we finally have some stability. Gratifications of a warm house and kitchen are significant, and they mean something different to somebody in 1845 than they mean to us now. There was hardships of living in this new world. Lots of bad winters. There were death, there were accidents. It took probably every waking hour of housekeeping to keep a household afloat. And things just weren't as gendered. And they weren't seen as feminine. The domesticity wasn't seen as feminine. Women chopped wood. Women worked on the farm. Men did bookkeeping, for example. So it just wasn't as I'm sure things were gendered, but not to the extent that we have gendered them today. And certainly the idea of a domestic space being feminine was not understood. And something, maybe the idea of domestic as something separate from survival was not understood. That came later with luxury. And luxury as a way of saying we have the privilege of seeing domesticity as a female space and traveling as a male space. We'll get to that again. Actually, the modernists are going to be the one who kind of disapprove of female poets in the early 1900s, and they're going to call this domestic space trivial and unimportant and not experimental enough. And experimental is going to start to mean traveling out. And the Beats are going to really pick up on this. We're going to go on the road as writers. We're going to go on the road, and that's going to be very male space. There's not many females included on this. And then music in the 60s and rock music in the 70s. This is going to really run with this idea. And this idea of gendering spaces. There's a whole set of essays, and I'm going to talk about this when we talk about playground poetry later in this class, about the outdoor space being male and the indoor space being female. And that's going to, that really finds its way into like MTV videos where the girl spaces are in bedrooms and the boy spaces are out on the street. There's tons of essays about this and how transgressive it was to see somebody like Tina Turner or Pat Benatar on the street at night in a video because that was a male space. So none of this even existed back in the mid-1800s. These are all ideas that happened in the 1900s to gender space. We will get to that. But right now, we are talking about pumpkin pie and a warm hearth where we are frozen. We've been playing in the snow, and we now are eating pudding. So this poem was made into a game book by Mary Dawson in 1916. It was gamified in that book. And that's when it became changed to Grandmother's House, so 1916. This is when we start to decide that the house belongs to a female. So leaving that poem, we're going to continue on to just to continue on that same idea, we're going to explore a few poems from the so-called sentimental women poets of this time.
And these poets were lost from the canon for many decades, and they've just now started to become rediscovered and brought back into the canon because they were women writers of the Victorian era. They were doing a lot of children's poetry, but they were also writing a lot of abolitionist poetry. And they were doing some subversive things that are being rediscovered. So hopefully we'll get to them again with their adult poems. But here are just, you know, three poems I'm going to mention before we finish up this section. One is Birthday Verses to a Little Girl by Lydia Sigourney, and it's from 1827. I could not find this poem online, but it was heavily published and republished in newspapers at the time. So I've added it to a section called Treasure Hunt, and we can just keep looking for it. We can just, for fun, we can check out our libraries and use bookstores and keep checking online, and maybe eventually we can see a copy of that. But it's in the Treasure Hunt section. And I've also included a link to a poem called The Child's Address to the Kentucky Mummy from 1836 by a poet called Hannah Flagg Gould. And she was another woman who did some veiled statements about abolitionism, abolishing slavery. And her tactic in this poem was to use a child speaker to make an adult point. And this was not uncommon at the time, to write as children in a way of saying difficult adult things. But it's really an adult voice making an adult point. This is something Angela Sorby points out. It's just a convention that's helping land the message. And this is very much a poem, I think, that is in the context of its time and what we would let children see back then versus what we would let them see now. Would we take a child to see a mummified person today? I don't think some parents would. They would think that's maybe too scary. But children back then were very familiar with the physicality of death. And so maybe we would shield children today in ways we didn't back then. Also, this is somebody's relative. This is actually a poem about a mummified Native American and a person in a museum or in a kind of a museum traveling. I don't know if it's a traveling museum or a larger museum, but this is something we wouldn't see today, because today we would repatriate this mummified person to its tribe and they would give it a proper burial. So in a way, this poem is about the gap in how we think about things today and how we might have approached things in the past. But even if you read the poem in the context of its time, it's still about protecting the past, because the child is trying to work out what we have, or what the narrator of the poem has in common with this person, this ancient person, things, you know, humanity in common. So it's about, you know, a fight against othering people because they're in a museum and they're mummified and they look very different. It's also about protecting the past. It's a site of conflict, because repatriation is still controversial. And that speaks to the multicultural nature of this country and how tangled the threads are. If you saw a relative dead in a freak show setting or a museum, you might be pretty upset. And so that's how we read the poem today. But the narrator is kind of trying to move toward that, even in the poem. So the poem is about the passage of time and this cultural gap between us, how we are now, the narrator experiencing this, and the person who's the mummy in this Kentucky setting. So it's also about innocence to experience. So it's a fascinating poem. The last poem I'm going to mention, we don't have a link to it again, was a poem called Trumpet Flowers, from 1883 by a woman named Sarah Pyatt. And it's again another example of a child's voice in dialogue with other voices. But it has this trope of barefoot boys that we're going to come up against. We're going to see this over and over again, sort of the wildness of childhood. And we're going to see it again pretty soon, because we're going to talk about the fireside poets next.